Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Education Committee. I'd like to call our committee to order. A couple of work sessions first, and then we'll move into our agenda. I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 2150. Quick summary of this consensus bill. Richard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2150 modifies the contents of and process for approval to establish a public charter school. It modifies processes for renewal and termination of the charter schools for public charter schools. It clarifies a list of laws that apply to public charter schools. It is a consensus amendment. The committee heard this bill once before on the 30th of April. The committee has been asked to consider the Dash A5 amendments, which kind of alter the requirements for board composition as specific to rural areas where they might not be able to fully staff a board.
Okay. Committee? Senator Canope? We're in a work session.
Chair Hass, I move to adopt the Dash A5 amendments dated April 29, 2013.
Senator Canote moves to adopt the Dash A5 amendments dated April 29, 2013. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none.
Chair Hass, I move House Bill 2150A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Canote moves House Bill 2150A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, I have been working with some other folks on this particular bill, and although I am moving it as is, I may change my mind on the floor depending on what they come back with in terms of, you know, there's been some controversy about this bill. There's been some uncertainty about it, and there are some folks who are waiting to hear from their attorneys as to how they feel this bill really does affect their particular charter schools. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
Fair enough. Further discussion? Seeing none. Is there objection?
Did we make a motion?
Yes.
Seeing none, House Bill 2150A, as amended, moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Roblin, would you carry this bill?
I will.
Okay, I'm going to close the work session and open up a work session on House Bill 2192. If you could give us a quick summary, Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2192 directs school districts, the school district boards, to adopt policies for the discipline, suspension, or expulsion of students. It has to do with zero tolerance conduct policies and revoked previously instated zero tolerance conduct policies. It declares an emergency effective on passage. And the committee previously heard this bill on the 9th of May.
Thank you. And we had a pretty good airing out of that bill then. We now have all the fiscal documentation in place. Senator Cope.
Chair Hass, I move to adopt the Dash A2 amendments dated May 9, 2013.
Senator Canote moves to adopt the Dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2192. Discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. So ordered.
Chair Hass, I move House Bill 2192A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Canote moves House Bill 2192A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Roblin?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Snow? Aye.
Chair Hass?
Hass votes aye. House Bill 2192A moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. I will carry that bill. All right. Close the work session on House Bill 2192. And we are going to move back and forth through these public hearings coming up here. I would begin briefly and temporarily because of some time constraints with Representative Gelser and her panel on House Bill 2747. So let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2747 with a quick summary from Richard, and Representative Springer is here on 2747 as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2747 describes student characteristics that district school boards can examine for terms of admission for non-resident students, in terms of giving consent. It describes information and other factors that school district boards may request or consider prior to giving consent or accepting non-resident students, and it allows the district school board to limit the number of students to whom the board will give consent.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. And just to clarify, Mr. Chair, do you want me to briefly give an overview of what the bill is?
That'd be great.
To provide some context.
What the bill is, what the problem it solves, and how we got to Albuquerque.
How we got to Albuquerque. Very, very well. Thank you.
We were supposed to go to Tucson. That's the problem. But anyway.
Since I follow Senator Cruz everywhere, is that where we're going next, to Tucson? So House Bill 2747 is intended to make sure that when school districts are considering whether to give consent to allow a student to leave their district or to enter their district on an inter-district transfer, that it's compliant with what is already Oregon law that prohibits discrimination based on the personal characteristics of students. The law already states, ORS 659.850, that discrimination means any act that unreasonably differentiates treatment, intended or unintended, or any act that is fair in form but discriminatory in operation, either of which is based on race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, national origin, marital status, age, or disability. It goes on to say that a person may not be subjected to discrimination in any public elementary, secondary, or community college education program or service, school or inter-school activity, or in any higher education program or service, blah, 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 that is financed in whole or in part by monies appropriated by the Legislative Assembly. Now, we assume that school districts follow these rules, and when we passed open enrollment legislation that this bill does not impact in 2011, one of the concerns that people raised was if students could move without any restriction, that there would be cherry picking, that districts would take only the best and the brightest students from neighboring districts. And so the legislature very intentionally put words into that legislation that said you cannot make decisions about a student entering your district based on their financial means, based on their race, based on their primary language, based on whether or not they have a disability, or based on the provisions of their IEP. And then we watched how the process was implemented. And what we learned over the course of the first year of the implementation of open enrollment was that several districts declined participation in open enrollment because they said they would have to comply with this idea of equity and equality and allowing any student to transfer in. And just a couple of quotes to describe the problem that have been printed in newspapers. In one district, a parent asked how the district would determine which students would be accepted into the district. The superintendent responded that administrators would review each student's transcript and that the district would not take students with behavioral issues. We wouldn't want any salvage projects academically. Another district talked about limiting their transfers based on where a student lived. And the response to a community member that was afraid that transfers would change the character and the makeup of the school district said that, "I believe the area we would be receiving students from is not an area that we will really benefit greatly from given the similar quality of their schools. And I don't think it's the best idea for us to try to use that as a way to try to make an advancement given what the downsides are." And those downsides were accepting students that spoke English as a second language and students with disabilities. There was another quote that talked about limiting enrollment from certain areas of a neighboring school district. Another one talked about if we accepted open enrollment with non-discrimination, it would change the character and nature of the school district, and therefore it would be important to restrict students by district boundaries. An attorney gave advice around special education saying that they needed to be careful in doing this so as not to violate the law. Districts are encouraged to proceed cautiously regarding enrollment caps for IDEA students to ensure that they do not engage in disability discrimination. Portland Public Schools said that they were not participating in open enrollment because under open enrollment, Portland would have to accept high needs, high cost special ed students from other districts. Under the current transfer system that Smith wants to continue, Portland can refer those high needs special ed students back to their home districts to get special ed services. It goes on and on with districts choosing not to participate in open enrollment because they want to pick and choose which students come. That is not consistent with the law. What House Bill 2747 does is limit what you can ask for on an application. It only has the information that a district is allowed to consider under the law, under these non-discrimination statutes, when considering enrollment of a student: their name, the grade level that they are about to attend, and their birth date. Once that student is accepted, then they can get all the information that they need so that they can plan to meet the needs of that student. The bill with the -3 amendment that's before you would allow districts to continue to set minimum standards for behavior and attendance for a student to be able to maintain enrollment in a district once they were accepted. But the primary premise of this bill is that all Oregon students deserve the right to access the same public school options as every other student, regardless of their financial means or their personal circumstances or characteristics. This bill is needed because the current practice in Oregon is denying movement to students that live in certain communities, to students that have certain disabilities, to students who speak English as a second language, and to many low-income students. I think that we need to trust that parents know best what the best school is for their child, that that student can choose where they wish to apply to enroll. A couple of other things: districts get to continue to decide how many spots are available. They don't have to take anybody. It's just once you open your boundaries, you're a public school, you have to accept all students. A district can still decide not to release students. This doesn't change any of that. It just says that everybody must be treated equally. Finally, the district can decide how long they allow a student to come in. That's a district decision. They can say this transfer is good for a year, it's good to the highest grade level, it's good through the end of graduation. That's different than open enrollment. Districts retain a great deal of flexibility with this. So I've brought with me today Sherry Springer, who's the Vice Chair of the Education Committee in the House, who's been a great partner on this bill. This bill has been a bipartisan priority in the House. And I also brought Wendy Boring to tell a story about how this has impacted her family. I know Wendy because her husband happens to be the principal of my children's high school, Corvallis High School, though she lives here in Salem, and she's a professor at Willamette University. I know that she needs to leave to pick up her wonderful son, Aaron, in a few minutes, so I will turn it over to her and defer questions until later. And I can stay for the whole hearing, so I can come back after other testimony to answer other questions you may have.
Thank you. I'm here just to testify on behalf of this bill. Sorry, I forgot. I'm Wendy Peterson-Boring. Last year we requested a transfer for our son Aaron Boring to transfer to Corvallis High School. He has just started as a freshman at South Salem High School. We live here in Salem. And we had discerned with our IEP team, a special ed team, that that was the best placement for him. We felt that the services there would be the best. Corvallis High School also had something that no other district had, which namely his dad. And the special ed team at Corvallis High School also thought that that was the best placement for him to accommodate his needs. Our transfer was denied, we were told, based on disability. They would not take him based on his disability. And it seems very unfair because if we had applied for our daughter, Emily, who's a 4-point student in the IB program with perfect SAT scores to go to Corvallis High School, I don't think she would have been denied. And it doesn't seem fair. I think Aaron deserves the same access to openings in public schools as his sister. And as far as I understand, this bill doesn't ask for unique privileges for special or unique kids to have special privileges. It just asks that they have the same privileges as everyone else. If high school is closed due to enrollment caps, I understand it'd be closed to Aaron too, but if it's open, it should be open to Aaron. It should be closed to him just based on his disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Springer, did you want to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Sherry Springer, State Representative, House District 17. I represent 5 school districts within my House district. And I want to share a very brief story with you and talk about why I think this bill is important and this statement needs to be made once again. And I have permission to share this story. Our son was on an IEP for several years, not a high-need student, but on an IEP. Good attendance, good behavior. I look at the application in one school in particular. I don't know that my son, after the fifth grade or during the fifth grade, would have been accepted. He was really struggling. Confidence was down, and I can look at an application with lots of characteristics that are asked about this student. There'd been some hard times in his school, in this classroom, had this IEP. Well, he is now a sophomore, and he has signed up, forecasted for next year, his junior year, to take an AP World History class. The point of that is, when we start asking that level of information on a one- or two-page document, do we really get a look at the student, especially when we're talking about public education here, publicly funded education? This bill has been, for me, from the very beginning, about a parent's right to choose what is best for their kid. We've just heard an example of that, very engaged parents choosing, yet that there was a problem with that. And I think that we need to keep in mind that we talk a lot about the parents' choice, we talk about the family, and I think we need to keep in mind that there's still barriers for families to do that. And I believe 2747 addresses those barriers. Certainly, if you have any questions, I'll answer those. But I think any time we have a publicly funded school and there's questions or at least innuendo about ability to pay, ability to add, not detract from their student population, I think those are very, very real but very shallow, frankly, assessments of who a student is in a school. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, for your information at your places, there's different districts have different kinds of applications. There is an application at your place for one district. You'll see it requires evaluations. One is rating of the student's kindness from usually thoughtful to unkind, a rating of their sense of humor from highly developed to poorly developed, questions about whether the parent's expectations of the student are consistent with their ability, emotional maturity, self-confidence. Is the student over confident or do they have a poor self-image? How will the student be accepted in a close-knit community? So this is a public school application. There are other districts that also have those applications. And I think you'll hear testimony today that says that without these applications, you won't be able to meet the needs of students. These are public schools. Public schools must stand ready to meet the needs of any child that walks through the door at any time. You don't fill out an application when you move into a neighborhood. A district is not obligated to take students from a neighborhood or a community outside their own community, but once they open those doors, they are a public school. And current applications in districts that just ask if you're on an IEP or if you're TAG, that provides no information. It provides for stereotype that this kid is on an IEP. It does not give you unique information about them. So this bill, colleagues, still gives districts tremendous ability to maintain the capacity of their district, the enrollment of their district. It allows them to maintain good behavior and attendance as a condition of a transfer being granted. But in the end, this is about public school. This is about all kids having equal choices because all kids have equal value. All kids can learn, and all parents know that there may be reasons why a child wants to attend a different school. Their dad works in the district, it's closer to their grandmother, or maybe they just need a fresh start. There shouldn't be artificial barriers based on their financial means or their personal characteristics, their disability, or their language. This bill fixes that, and it complies, frankly, with what is currently the law. Considering any of these things that this prohibits considering on an application would be a violation of state law right now and could put a district at risk of loss of state school funds.
Mr. Chair, I would submit that I think I have a great sense of humor. Senator Roblin doesn't necessarily think so.
He has work. But we're working on it.
We're working on it. You know, I mean, value judgments, give me a break.
Questions of our panel here? Okay, thank you for coming up. I'm glad we could accommodate.
Thank you.
We're going to come back to this bill here this afternoon. So let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2747A.
Wow.
And we will open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3341A. And Richard, could you give us a summary of the amendment before us?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3341A, in its current form, exempts public universities and community colleges from an existing requirement. The committee has been asked to consider the -A3 amendments, which replace the measure and repeal ORS 348.611, which is the adverse impact ability of for-profit schools.
And you may recall we had heard this bill last week. There was some discussion about how replacing and repealing the law would be the cleanest way to go about what the previous measure in its current iteration was trying to do. And so we have some people signed up to talk to us about that today. John Wyckoff, Patrick Lanning, and Joe Olson. I might also add that with the advent of the creation of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, that does tend to replace the strategic kind of coordination of our higher learning facilities here as well. Welcome, gentlemen.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association. Thank you for hearing us today on House Bill 3341. We come here in support of this bill and the Dash A3 amendments, which do just more cleanly remove this part of statute that we call adverse impact. And we talked more broadly about what that meant in the last hearing, so I won't go through that, just to simply reiterate, and then I will point you to an example. But just to quickly reiterate, as we look at this as the one statute, I think that the key effect that concerns us is that what it essentially does is limit options for students. In a community, and the example that I brought with me today comes from Central Oregon Community College, the one, in fact, that came up during the last hearing. You have written testimony from the president of Central Oregon, from Jim Middleton, where the college, at the request of the healthcare industry in their community, partnered with St. Charles Medical Clinic and the Bend Memorial Clinic to create a phlebotomy, a course in phlebotomy. It's a one course program that leads to an entry level job, a good paying entry level job in a clinic or hospital. And they had worked with local partners to create the program, had successfully done so, but were threatened by legal action by a proprietary institution in Eugene, who said that they offered that program and were already meeting capacity and were threatening legal action based on adverse impact. So the college shut down the course and have continued to hear from their community partners that is a healthcare pipeline access problem for the college. And that, what that means is that if you're a student in that area, because there is an existing for-profit program or because there is potentially an existing proprietary program, that will be the only option that you will have, that as a student you will not have a lower cost option from a community college, because we aren't allowed to offer it. And that very much narrows the option that as a student you will have for access to different types of programs from different types of providers. It means if this kind of provider was here first or plans to come there, that we are not able to do it. And it has a very, very much a chilling effect for the colleges on programs that they might like to offer, especially in these career and technical areas. And again, you heard from, I think, the advocates, a concern that a college may come in and with a subsidy for our programs come in and put some folks out of business. And I think the reality is what we're able to do in situations like this is offer a few slots at a lower cost for students. But in because these tend to be our higher cost programs requiring clinical settings and things like that, what we're doing is offering a few more choices for students. We're not going to be able to, in many cases, fully meet this need. It's about working, it's about having many options to get to that 40-40-20 goal of the state. And with that, I will close. And we'll happily answer any questions or turn over to my two colleagues I have with me today, Patrick Lanning from Chomeketa Community College's Yamhill Valley campus in McMinnville, and Joe Olson from Umpqua Community College, to talk about how they see this from their campus president perspective.
Thank you, John. Gentlemen?
Thank you, John. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be here. This is my first opportunity to be before a committee since coming to Oregon 2 years ago. It's always a pleasure for me.
Start out with your ID, Mr. President.
I'm Joe Olson. I'm a resident of the city of Sutherland, and I'm president of Umpqua Community College in Roseburg, Oregon. Again, it's great to be here. I want to address a couple points that John brought up, and one is costs. Douglas County is one of the poorer districts in the state. Our students have limited access to higher education because of the cost of education and because of the size of Douglas County. We're in the process of developing two new programs that we think could dramatically impact our ability to give workforce training to citizens in Douglas County that would be, we think, at a much lower cost than a for-profit institution. One of these is natural resource management, which has a direct tie to the timber industry, which is so important to the entire state of Oregon. And I had the opportunity to listen to Alan Ford yesterday, who talked about the fact that the timber industry is recovering, albeit slowly, and there will be a demand for more highly trained students in Douglas County. Another program that we are in the first steps of contemplating is in drone technology. There's a company that is partially based out of Roseburg, Invictus Technology. We've been talking with them for about a year. Now, I know that there is some controversy around drone technology. Nonetheless, we do think that it could provide jobs for the people of Douglas County. So that is my own internal perspective of it. And this is the only state that I'm aware of that has this adverse impact policy. So.
Chair Haas, Patrick Landing. I'm the campus president for the Yamhill Valley campus in McMinnville for Chemeketa. In addition, I'm also the chief academic officer for the Chemeketa district. And for the past 12 years, I've been responsible both at Lane Community College and here in Salem with Chemeketa in developing career technical programs. I've actually run into developing programs where we've actually been stopped. And I was shocked to find out about this legislation in the hard way after we'd had businesses come together as an advisory committee, really requesting a program, go through the work to develop the program, the curriculum with those business owners, and then find out that it can just be stopped by a Portland college, for-profit college. And we've had further programs since I went through that difficult learning experience where we've had just more recently the truck driving is starting to pick up in the Willamette Valley, and we've had requests because the private school just north of us is not meeting demand. And they've been very clear to us, we will block your opportunity to do that. And so this really is shutting out the ability for Chemeketa to meet those regional training needs. And I think it's very clear, being the only state that has this, it's not a level playing field. It's not where we want to be if we care about the ability to meet industry demands. We have over 350 business and industry leaders that serve on our advisory committees at Chemeketa. And when we explained to them we were having to pull back on this program, they were shocked that this existed. And both in healthcare and then in the truck driving area, those are key pieces of what we need to be doing to support our local industry and economy. So I'd be happy to answer questions.
I'm surprised that are you saying you're trying to develop a program in Salem, but a Portland college can stop you, or you're trying to
Correct.
Do something in Bend and a Eugene college can stop you? What,
Correct.
There's no geographic boundary.
No geographic boundaries, and they don't even have to have an existing program. That's what, and this was 4.5 years ago. They still have not developed that program. That's the sad part. They can just have the idea they're going to develop it and say, you know, you're in our zone of recruitment, and that's how we were stopped. So it's not a level playing field.
Can you characterize what this does, not just in the terms where there's a concrete effort and you're stopped, but what it does when you're formulating whether to even pursue a policy?
It actually stops us from moving forward. We actively tell our advisory committees there's laws that keep us from moving forward. And that's why I think this has been at the top of the list for the chief academic officers in the state of the community colleges and the community college presidents for us to create a more balanced playing field in the state of Oregon. So it keeps us from moving forward, because why would you put the energy in when you know that it's going to be stopped before you can ever move forward? So we just don't put, you know, I'm going to guess on the number, but I believe we put in over 100 hours of preparation with the curriculum development, working with industry, and then it was stopped at that point because you have to apply for this adverse impact.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was under the impression that if you're starting a new program in a community college or university for that matter, that you had to get approval by Department of Education or now I think it's the HEC. Is that incorrect?
That That is true, but you have to develop the actual program. You have to, I mean, it doesn't make sense for any community college to develop a program where there are no jobs. So that's why we pull together the business and industry to say, what is the industry demand? And for us, it's our Tri-County area. And look at that, it's Douglas County for Umpqua. So we pull those people together, but now we've actually stopped in some of those industries pulling people together because we know that those for-profit schools are very clear. We're gonna come forward with adverse impact as soon as you go to that step. As soon as you file, that's when the adverse impact report goes out to those private institutions, and that's where they stop it, is at that step.
So what's the considerations that the, I guess it's the heck now, in terms of duplication of services, what's their standard that they apply?
Chair Haas, Senator Beyer, if I may. When, you know, when, for example, for our programs, or I believe if you were looking at OUS, it would go currently to the Oregon University System Board. But these are the sorts of things that, as Senator Haas was pointing to at the beginning of the hearing, will start to move under the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And so what they would be looking at would be things like, is there a workforce demand for the program being started? You would have the Higher Education Coordinating Commission probably say, you know, we don't want one of the other major universities to start another school of social work in downtown Portland because we already have a big one. And so they tend to look for those sorts of issues where you might have a public program butting up right against another public program, or where there might not be a workforce need. And they also look at whether you've met standards so that you have, so that it's an academically worthwhile program. And so those sorts of program approval decisions will still rest at probably depending on where some of this legislation goes with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, whereas it's sort of bifurcated now with the community colleges at the State Board of Education and the universities going through the University System Board.
Do they also assess whether there's private courses that are already provided?
Well, currently, yes. Then that happens through the Office of Degree Authorization, and that is the adverse impact process. But what it really looks at is whether it may impact a program of an existing proprietary school, and then that's what that part of the process does. But that exists under the Office of Degree Authorization, which has already been moved to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
Senator Rublin?
No, I'm good.
Go ahead. What's your question? Senator Cruz?
I think Mr. Olson, you could probably talk about some of the cooperative programs that you have relative to the community and actually with some private with truck driving and a few things like that you've already made arrangements to where it isn't a competition thing. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. And our truck driving program is expanding. And I would hate for that to be stymied by some other competitor coming in and charging significantly more than what we do for what is a tremendous need in Douglas County and throughout the timber industry. But we have approximately 30 requests for trained truck drivers just in the last few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair, for our part of the state, it's also a question of, there may be a really good program in Portland, but if you live in Gold Beach, that doesn't work very well. And I know like Umpqua has been trying to get a campus in the southern part of Douglas County. We'll try that again, by the way, before we're done. Because a lot of the people, kids in Douglas County, it's in just an hour just to get to the Umpqua campus, let alone any other place. So my fear, Mr. Chair, and we will keep an eye on this, is I don't want the pendulum to swing too far. There is an incredible value in the for-profit institutions and the services that they offer. And I know there are some people in this world who thinks that nobody should make any money on education, but a for-profit and a community college still have to meet the same bottom line. So for me, that definition's always been blurred. I view this as trying to level the playing field, not prejudice one way or the other. And, Mr. Chair, we will keep an eye on it as we roll it out.
And if I may, Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, with the trajectory that the state of Oregon has put our funding on over the last several years, you're in no danger of us, I think, out-competing anybody.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'm also looking at this because we so tremendously underfund community colleges. This gives them an opportunity to do some program expansion to at least keep their heads above water.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you very
much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Jessica Adamson.
Are you wondering how I'm going to vote?
No, I think you said it again.
I know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. We are here in strong opposition to the Dash 3 amendment. So we shared with you about a week ago when this bill was first heard, we have concerns about the base bill. The Career Colleges Federation are strong supporters of all of Oregon higher education. We all need to work together. We all need to collaborate together to meet the state's ambitious 40-40-20 goals. We play a small part of that equation. We are a very highly regulated sector. We are more regulated in this state than we are in others. We have two different offices that regulate two different sectors of the for-profit industry. We work very hard to support those agencies in the work that they do. We believe that there's an opportunity there for better collaboration among those agencies. We've talked with you about that as well. This bill, as it came over from the House, made a pretty significant adjustment in the adverse impact statute. Adverse impact, as we talked about, is designed to make sure that when the public is expanding into a new area, that they're not doing so where there isn't demonstrated student need. Not that there is an absolute bar. This isn't a legal environment. This is a regulatory conversation. Is there demonstrated student need, unmet student need, in an area where there's a proposed expansion? And there's a lengthy process. That process has been modified as of 2009. We were very proud to be a part of that process. That change in 2009 has resulted in career pathway programs working very effectively. As this bill came over from the House, again in a form that we didn't love, but was better than it existed originally, this bill now forces simply a conversation. So if you're going to expand a program, there's no ability to bar. There's no one that can say, no, you can't move forward. All they need to do is sit down and have a conversation if someone believes that there might be an adverse impact. And if there isn't an agreement at the end of that conversation, they can then move forward with the expansion anyway, over our objection. It doesn't. They can do that in the A and Gross bill. The Dash 3 amendment completely eliminates that conversation. It prevents any moment of attempt to collaborate between the public sector and the private sector, which our position is we ought as a state to be encouraging more than ever at this moment where we're trying to leverage limited resources and yet expand educational access for as many Oregonians as possible. We appreciate that a law that's been in place for decades from time to time needs to be updated. We would be very pleased to be part of that conversation. However, this bill with a Dash 3 amendment eliminates the opportunity for a conversation. It eliminates collaboration or a moment to try and find a way to do that. Instead, it would replace this entire statute, would eliminate it. Instead of finding ways to promote additional collaboration between private and the public sector, something we strongly support, This bill, if the Dash 3 amendment is adopted, would stop that. And we ask you today to please reject the Dash 3 amendment. We are not in love with House Bill 3341. We believe that there can be a better bill, that there can be a better conversation with this. And, Mr. Chair, we would be more than happy to come to the table and try and address the problems and the concerns that were raised by the previous people at this table. We all have to be in this together. And I commit to you that my organization would be happy to do that. However, the Dash 3 amendment precludes that conversation, and we ask you today to reject that amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jessica, doesn't the, and I have my agencies confused, but doesn't the approval process for a new course take that into consideration? If a community college is starting a new program, Myers, understanding is they have to get the approval to do that, and I assume the regulator, whomever that is going to take all of this into consideration before they do that approval.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, it is the current process by which they do that is through the adverse impact process, in which the private sector can say there's something going on that this could conflict. This statute, if it's completely repealed, eliminates that moment of conversation. There's no requirement at that point in time that any impact to the private sector or to the private schools on a program that's already been there for decades, there's a new one that's going to come in. There's no moment, there's no direction to the agency to consider that potential conflict when approving a new program for a public sector. That moment doesn't exist. As it is currently written, there at least needs to be a conversation. The two sides have to come sit together at a table and have a conversation about ways to try and figure this out. If that does not work, then both sides go away and the public sector may move forward with establishing their program regardless of whether there was any resolution.
But again, my assumption, I think the intent of creating the HEC was that the HEC as the regulator would consider all of that, because the whole purpose was to avoid unnecessary duplication, whether it's public or private, was to looking at that. So I would assume that is their job, and if that isn't their job, then maybe we need to revisit that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we would strongly concur with that. We would ask, we are not aware of any such direction, any such requirement for them to consider private sector impact or any ability for us to weigh into that process in a way in which we have any level of standing. So we would ask, before this statute is repealed, to be very careful about making sure that your intent is actually included in there, so that there isn't a break in process.
Further questions?
Yep, Mr. Chair.
Senator Cano.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jessica, a couple of examples we heard related to the public in a certain region being stopped by a private in another region. Is there a reason the law as it exists today isn't regionalized, so you're having that conversation with privates that are actually from your area?
Mr. Chair, Senator Canope, that is something that is an issue that is new to me, that I was unaware that was occurring. Again, that is something that if that's happening, and I have no reason to doubt the fine folks that were in front of us, it's something that we would be willing to look at. There's some limit, again, that the purpose of the law is if there is an actual need, an unmet student need, whether in a geographic region or statewide, there should be no issue with them being able to get their program approved. A regionalization approach would be something we would be willing to look at.
Follow up? Yeah, I mean, I on the phlebotomy example with COCC and being stopped by, according to the testimony, a private in Eugene, it just seems like that might be a way to go versus You know, I guess I'm concerned. I want to make sure that there's a level playing field between public and private.
Absolutely.
And I don't want to see us move forward with an amendment that changes the entire landscape without actually looking at some other options before we do that. The underlying bill, I didn't like because I thought it was cumbersome and complicated. And it seems like if there was a conversation with everybody that we might be able to get to some sort of a consensus product, but I don't feel like that's taken place. Can you speak to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Canope, there has not been a work group or an effort to sit down and see if we could reach a compromise on this bill. That is something that we would be willing to engage in and come to the table and find solutions to these problems that have been raised and their legitimate concerns.
Okay. There was no House work group?
Mr. Chair, no, there was not.
Further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Emma Calloway.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association, and we're here today to speak in support of 3341. Right now, it's our understanding from our community college students that if a community college wants to open an EMT or a fire program, for example, and a proprietary school already has one or said that they would like to open one soon, then that community college would not open that program. And we think that part of this conversation is about cost, but that's really just a small portion of it. Preparatory schools can be 2 and 3 times the cost of a community college program, and we think that the ability to open just a few slots in a community college program allows for some options. We think that our community colleges, as Mr. Wyckoff said, is not going to overshadow the for-profit school industry, and we also know that we really need for-profit and proprietary schools to get to 40-40-20. What we like about this bill is that it levels the playing field a little bit more, and it opens up or might open up some community college slots that could be more affordable for students. In House Bill 3120, to your question, Senator Beyer, that bill does bring in the Office of Degree Authorization into the HEC, and we think that that's a great way of creating a board to have a conversation about for-profit schools, not-for-profit schools, public schools, all within the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, which I think was one of its original intents. We think that the conversation around unmet need is just a portion of this conversation, that unmet need is an issue, but also different options, different levels of quality. For-profit schools, if they are more expensive in some cases, can provide a higher level of quality. And then we allow the free market to have a conversation about competition and increasing quality in some areas and opening up some affordable options in other areas. And we like that. We like that option for students. So we think this bill is about improving quality through competition. We think this bill could be about affordability, and we think this bill is definitely about options. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Canope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Emma, what was the community college budget in this last biennium?
About $395 million after we had the holdbacks in the second year of the biennium.
Follow up. So I'm a simple guy, and the state is giving the publics, right, $395 million. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's reasonable to, at least for me to assume, that they could probably, with those funds, be able to put on some of these programs for maybe less cost than a private would, because we're not giving the privates $395 million.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what I'm missing here. Why is that a level playing field?
We think it's a level playing field because it allows for the for-profit schools have the option to increase tuition higher. They aren't subject to possible budget caps or other things that the public are subject to. And so they have, proprietary schools have more options to increase quality. They have less regulation or scrutiny than our public schools do. And so there is a conversation not just about level playing field of the price and the cost, but about they're able to offer a different type of product, and we want the community colleges to be able to do what they can with their resources and offer another type of product.
So you think, so you think the amendment that's being proposed levels that playing field by just completely getting rid of the law altogether?
Yes, I do.
Further questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We close public hearing on House Bill 3341A and open up a work session on House Bill 3341A.
You might want to give that to somebody else.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's all right.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A3 amendment to House Bill 3341A.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash A3 amendments stated May 10, 2013 to House Bill 3341A. Discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd feel a lot more comfortable if we were moving forward had there been some sort of opportunity work group to happen this cycle. It doesn't seem like that's happened from the testimony. I'm concerned about that we haven't tried to reach some sort of better consensus, and so I'm going to oppose the amendment to this bill.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Rumblin.
Aye.
No.
House votes aye. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3341A as amended by the Dash A3 amendment to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3341A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support the motion. And it's basically, it's a faith that the HEC and others will take these things up. I know in the past, when I worked with these programs, it was many years ago, there was a fairly rigorous review process. And I from discussions the chair and I have had in the past on this issue, the HEC, that was the intent, was that the HEC would do that. And I assume they would be looking at all public and private and making sure that there's a non-duplication and out there, and there was a reasonable access for students. The most important thing, in my mind, is making sure that students have access to the courses that they need to be successful, and the businesses have training programs that they need to support their labor force, and I'm not overly concerned about protecting anybody's turf.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I could have similar comments to Senator Byer, but I would also suggest that I know in the part of the world that Senator Roblin and I live in, there are going to be some pretty amazing opportunities presented to community colleges, and I want to make sure that the process is not too cumbersome. By the same token, I also want to make sure that we're not prejudicing the system in favor of community colleges over the private schools as well. I think they both have an incredibly important role to play in our education system, and I'm hoping that what we'll find is a level playing field.
Senator Rowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree. My biggest concern about going as we move forward with this bill is the fact that I do know that when a community college starts a new program, they invite the local community and they find out if the need is there. And I think need has to be the major projector. And it has to be looking at the whole system and whether we can, in fact, and need to have the programs to do that. And I hope that HEC takes that up, but I know the community colleges have an emphasis in that. And the ones that I've worked with have always felt that was the number one priority with respect to making a new deal with it. And it wasn't just the short-term need, but the longer-term need as well. And I encourage that to be a consideration, because if the programs are already there providing it, they should be working in the places where they're not being provided for kids that couldn't do it. So,
thank you. Thank you all. Senator Knope?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I didn't want to be left out. All these guys are saying stuff. And so if you'll say something after me, yeah, all of us would have said something. I really believe that we're going to need both private and public to reach 40-40-20. And it seems to me that right now, community colleges, generally speaking, are succeeding, and the privates seem to be succeeding. And I didn't hear a lot of testimony about significant problems. Yes, there's a problem with a phlebotomy program with COCC and a provider in Eugene, and there clearly have been some others. But I don't think we're hitting the middle ground here. If our problem is the fly, I think we're using a cannon to eliminate the problem with this bill, and I'm just concerned about that. So I am going to be a no on this and a no on the floor. And I respect the opinions of my colleagues here and of course, the chair. But I kind of feel like that we haven't quite finished this bill yet, but I think it's finishing me. So with that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think some of you might be surprised to know that I once taught writing for one of these for-profit universities, and they do a good job, and I'm on good terms with them. And I just think that, you know, we complain a lot about how many laws we pass and we never repeal them, even when modern times dictate. And we have modernized our higher educational system with the creation of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, which has a job to make sure that we don't have 17 nursing schools in Gresham and have enough truck driving courses in Roseburg. And I think that's where we are now, and I think this bill is outmoded. That plus I do think there's a degree of unfairness in having a for-profit institution in Portland dictate whether or not a community college in Roseburg can offer truck driving courses. It's just a matter of fairness. So with that.
Mr. Chair, just one more if I could.
Senator Cruz.
I hate it when you get the last word.
I know you do. You have the last word. Go ahead.
Okay. I would also suggest that we're now an annual legislative assembly, and we can take a look at this over the interim. And if we are finding that more work needs to be done, we can certainly create the work group to look at that. So this may force some people to get a little more real in the discussions. And so at the end of the day, this may be a very good thing.
Thank you. We're under discussion. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byers.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Roblin.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Knope. No.
Chair
House. House votes yes. House Bill 3341A, as amended, moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. I'll carry this bill. And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3341. Okay. We've got some signers over here, so we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2757. Richard, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2757 directs the Department of Education to ensure that a statewide assessment system or an alternative to a statewide assessment system is available for students whose primary language is American Sign Language. It allows students whose primary language is American Sign Language to be exempt from high school diploma requirements related to assessments of content standards if the assessments cannot be administered using American Sign Language. It declares an emergency effective 1st of July, 2013. We previously heard this bill. Oh, the committee has not previously heard this bill. Excuse me.
We had a couple false starts.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if Rep. Gelser, do you want to? Rep. Gelser is here. Did you want to bring some people with you or? I'm going to go out on a limb and guess this is Viviana and Tedlin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm still Sarah Gelser, State Representative from House District 16, Chair of the House Education Committee. You have before you House Bill 2757. It is trying to fix a problem. We learned yesterday, late-breaking news, that there is a problem with the way that this bill is drafted. We're working with the department. The department is here to get it drafted in the right way so that it does not have the $1.2 billion fiscal that was attached to it today. We had the Golden Turkey Award. I was hoping to win the Golden Fiscal Award, and I think
that's close.
I dare you to try to beat me.
The agency could absorb that.
This fund may not be big enough, and that comes from a concern that the way the language is written could put all of our federal funds at risk. The bill is trying to do a very simple thing. In order to get a high school diploma in Oregon, you need to hit the proficiency scores on the OAKS when you graduate. If your primary language is in Spanish, you are allowed to take that test in Spanish. If your primary language is Russian, you are allowed to take that test in Russian. If you are deaf and you have never heard spoken English and you have never learned spoken English and your primary language is ASL, it's currently not possible to do that. The way that even on a reading test that ASL works, ASL and English are not the same language. So we have very bright students who are unable to get a high school diploma simply because of that OAKS test. They have met all of the other requirements. And because of a change in federal law, they are no longer eligible for any form of Pell Grant or federal loan. As a result, we've had students in Oregon in the last couple of years that have finished their 4 years of high school, applied to college, received admission to four-year institutions and financial aid packages, then took the OAKS, did not hit the cut score, and are now unable to go to college. I don't think that's what we want to be about, and that's what the bill, when we fix it, will do. And we have two students here today who are of transition age that this has impacted to tell you their stories, and so that you can see the students that we are talking about are bright, competent students that aren't just four-year college students. These are individuals that could be doctors, attorneys, graduate students, and that OAKS is a barrier that does not need to be there based on ASL being a primary language. And you'll start by saying your name first for the record, and you can just tell your story from there.
Good afternoon, chairs, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Tedlin Giron. Oh, excuse me. The interpreter got that wrong. Tedlin Genetiano. And I'm from OSD, Oregon School for the Deaf. I was a student there. And I would like to voice my support for the test being given in ASL. My first language was English as I was growing up, but that was until I reached eighth grade. And then I started to learn ASL. Because I went into the deaf program. And I started to learn, and I realized that I was able to learn ASL, and that actually became my primary language rather than English. And so my goal is to be able to take the OAKS test and to be able to pass it so that I would be able to go to a four-year university or a four-year college. I'm signing. I don't need the microphone. good afternoon, Chairperson. My name is Viviana Girion, and I'm a student from the Oregon School for the Deaf. And I would like to tell you a little bit of my experience from growing up. I was born hearing, but I got very sick and lost my hearing and became deaf. And I'm the only one deaf in my family. My whole family are hearing. And they don't know how to sign with me. So they tried to teach me how to speak. There was no sign language growing up. They tried to teach me how to speak. And then I moved here from another country, and I started to learn ASL. And that became my second language. And I really tend to struggle with English. I also would like to have success in passing the Oaks test. And I'm very, very upset that I haven't been able to do that. I haven't given up. I continue to work hard, and I keep trying to do that because I would like to get a regular diploma rather than a modified diploma. And so that is my goal, to be able to take the test in ASL.
Thank you both very much.
Well done. Committee, any questions?
Okay. Thank you. And I think the department is here to explain the problem and how we can fix it.
So you don't have a revenue package that can fill the 1.2?
Well, we could talk about a revenue package, but probably not today.
Colleen Thayer and Cindy Hunt. I know, Cindy, you have written testimony.
Okay, I'm not sure. Am I supposed to be up here at this point, or is this
Colleen? Yes, Christine? She should go ahead.
Oh yes. Okay, me. All right. I'm Colleen. Yes. First, I would like to say thank you to the students for their experience and sharing that with us. I don't think a lot of people understand the impact of the Oaks when students take this test to get a standard diploma. And if they don't get that standard diploma, if they don't pass it, the effect on their future is huge. They can't go into a four-year college, and no one will accept them. They can't get financial aid. They can't apply for FAFSA or anything. And so they're very limited. They have a very limited future, and they have dreams of working, of getting good jobs, and they're very limited on what they're going to be able to do. And so what can they become? With just a modified diploma. It makes them actually dependent on the welfare system. They would like to continue with their education after graduation. And really, it's not their fault. You know, some are born deaf, some are born hearing and then become deaf, but their language is delayed. And maybe it's because the parents only speak to the children and there are no signs being used. They don't have exposure to ASL until they get into kindergarten. And so they start kindergarten at 5 years old, and that's when they start to get their language. And then they start to learn sign language or oral, an oral language maybe. But really, you know, they have the IEPs and everything that they set up, and they have a preferred language and all of that, and they get exposure to language, but it's not until later. But then some kids go into a mainstream school with interpreters, and they learn how to sign, but that's really not an exposure to the printed word. And really, the assessment tests all focus on what's printed on the paper and their proficiencies, and they have to satisfy those proficiencies. And they really need to be tested in their first language as foreign language speakers are able to do. They need it. There are accommodations for Spanish, for Russian, for other students who can hear, but they use other languages. But there's no effort to resolve this issue for the students who use ASL as their primary language. And it seems like it's a punishment to them. They're being penalized because they can't hear. And there's been no resolution up to this point, and this is my concern, is for their future.
Thank you. Questions? We thank you and the students for coming.
Hi, Cindy Hunt, Oregon Department of Education. At the Department of Education, we wouldn't disagree with a lot of what's been said today. And in fact, I'm very pleased to see Oregon School for the Deaf students testifying in front of you and also in the audience learning firsthand how our governmental system works. As you're aware, we administer the OSD, and so anytime we have kind of our students here, I think it's a good day. Also, just to kind of put a cap on it, for students who are deaf, learning to read is often a significant challenge, and I think you've heard about that firsthand today. The other piece of information I'd like to add is that, on average, when a student who is deaf enters the Oregon School for the Deaf, they are typically four grade levels behind their hearing peers for reading. So you hear a little bit today, some anecdotal evidence, but that's on average a student at the School for the Deaf. And we definitely appreciate the intent of the bill because as we move to 40-40-20, obviously we want all students to graduate and all students to have post-secondary opportunities available to them. So the intent of the bill is great. On the second page of my testimony, I outlined the actual requirements of the bill and some of the issues that we saw in it. And I think that there's a couple of issues with the bill, and Representative Gelser kind of stole my conclusion earlier. But before I get to that, the first section of the bill directs the Department of Ed to administer the statewide assessment system to students whose primary language is American Sign Language. We do that now. We administer the test to every student in Oregon as required by federal law. So the bill is not requiring something in addition to federal law, at least in Section 1. So we're not sure exactly what the intent there is with that section. But in Section 2 of the bill talks about for students whose primary mode of communication is American Sign Language, that those students would be exempt from requirements relating to assessments of content standards. Currently, there's two requirements related to assessments of content standards. The first requirement is that all students take the statewide assessment, OAKS. The second requirement is that it is one of the ways that you can demonstrate proficiency in essential skills, and particularly in reading that you've heard about, but other essential skills as well. So the bill would say that a student whose primary mode is ASL would be exempt from those requirements. So the first one around being exempt from the statewide assessment, that's the one that we think there is an issue under federal law, because federal law under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act very clearly says if you have an educational service you're offering to some students, you need to offer it to all students, and you cannot exempt a group of students based on disability. And the other piece of federal law, also in accepting some of the monies under the federal waiver of NCLB, we also agreed as a state to test all students under the statewide assessment system. So that's how we get to the $1.2 billion fiscal. But moving away from that a little bit, the second requirement on assessments is around essential skills and demonstrating that students know how to read when they graduate from high school. We now have local options for students to be able to use in addition to the statewide assessment to demonstrate that they have achieved the essential skill of reading. Many of these local options do have an accommodation for American Sign Language. So the students who are offered these local options would not be exempted from the requirement that they meet the essential skill of reading. As, you know, some of the testimony here today, you know, expressed that was one of the intents of the bill. The other thing I'd like to cover today is that on the front page of the testimony, for the past couple of years, the Department of Education convened an accommodations panel to really look at the statewide assessment system globally and what kind of accommodations should be being offered, not just to students who whose primary language is American Sign Language, but to all students with disabilities. And the conclusion of that accommodations panel is that accommodations are given to other subjects other than reading. The assessment for reading is testing reading in English specifically, so that's why the accommodation wasn't given for the assessment in reading, but for all the other subjects, there is an accommodation for American Sign Language. So, for example, the assessment in writing, when you're giving the direction to the kids on, like, what is the question for writing, the directions are signed if the student's primary language is American Sign Language, just to give you an example. In the mathematics test, the directions, you know, on how to, you know, the problem for mathematics, for example, it is signed to them. And so I wanted to give you that background as well. And also, you know, what we're looking at the agency is a more global solution to this issue of kids receiving an Oregon diploma. Because as we move to 40-40-20 and attempt to get our state's graduation rate above 68%, we want more kids who have disabilities to graduate with an Oregon diploma. And so regardless of the passage of this bill, that is a topic that we are committed to in the next year, really looking at policies, whether they be accommodations policies or other policies around the Oregon Diploma, and looking at what policies create barriers for kids, some of which you heard from today. And so with that, we are working with Representative Gelser and others to try to address some of the issues in this bill that I've highlighted.
Well, I don't think there's anybody up here that doesn't want to see them go to a four-year university. I know you
right.
share that, too. So your concerns were raised, though, after the House took action?
Yes, Chair Haas. The bill went through the House very quickly. And we were looking at the bill as originally as a bill on what accommodations should be given and for which subjects. And then we heard some of the testimony on the bill that day in the House, and we also started researching what other states are doing in this area. And I can tell you that Washington, California, and some of our other neighboring states, none of them give an exemption for American Sign Language specifically. And so then we started thinking about it as, wait a minute, you know, giving an exemption for one group of students based on disability, That raised the issue of the federal funds for us, and then we reached out to the U.S. DOE, but we have not gotten an answer on that. That's why it's a may jeopardize in this.
Okay. So, Senator Roblin?
So the issue is we are required, and we have always done, when it's Oaks or any other assessment, if there's a part of it that we can translate for people, we do that, but they still have to perform the skill. So the only exception to that is reading. And
right.
You would do the directions maybe in reading in sign language, but then they would have to read the passage and be able to demonstrate in writing or whatever that they've read it. Is that the way it goes?
Yeah, Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, one of the things that's happened with Oaks in the last couple of years is that up until the last few years, taking Oaks was a matter for school districts, and it was a judgment on school right. districts, you know, what's our graduation rate, that kind of thing.
Right.
When the passage of essential skills became part of the Oregon Diploma, it becomes more individualistic, and that's why you see the work of the accommodations panel looking at individual students and what's appropriate accommodations. Right. And so, and that's why as the essential skill of reading and other essential skills are kind of phased into the Oregon Diploma, more and more districts are becoming aware of other local options. Other local options are being developed for students to be able to demonstrate that they've met the essential skills, even outside of kids whose primary language is American Sign Language. It's just all kids. And so as we see this develop, more and more options are being available to kids. And certainly at the Oregon School for the Deaf and otherwise, the expectation is that all kids will, you know, meet the essential skill of reading. And many kids who are deaf do meet that standard.
Senator Rubin.
So are we working on accommodations at the School of the Deaf as local districts are since it's their school?
Right. Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, yes, we are looking at the Deputy Superintendent Saxton, I can say with a great amount of confidence, is very focused on the achievement of students at the School for the Deaf and raising all achievement levels, whether it be the high school graduation rate, you know, reading, mathematics scores, et cetera.
Okay. Further questions? Okay, still very much work in progress. Don't give up.
So,
thank you.
This isn't perfect. Apparently, they didn't send it to the Ways and Means from the other side with a minor $1.2 billion. It's amazing what the House can do.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2757, and I know time is
rounding
away from us. We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3254A. Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3254A establishes the instructor license and teacher leader license. It renames the continuing teaching license to professional teaching license, and it limits the renewal of the initial teaching license to three renewals. The current amendment in front of the committee are the -A8s. Those amendments abolish the continuing teacher license and create the professional teacher license and teacher leader license. That mandates that the Oregon Education Investment Board determine a career pathway structure for educational assistants to become licensed teachers no later than July 1st, 2014.
Phil Donovan and your panel. We've got Charlie Jett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Chalkboard Project, here to express our support for House Bill 3254. Being circulated right now, and our subject matter expert, Dr. Nancy Golden, who apologizes, but she could not be here, but some written remarks from her are being shared with you. Fortunately, though, one of her teachers, who is one of the inspirations for this legislation, is here with me today, and he can talk about how the Springfield Master Teachers Programs helped teachers and helped give rise to House Bill 3254. So I'd like to allow him to share his experience with you, and then I'll summarize our support and describe the Dash 8 amendment very briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Charlie Jett, and I am a 7th grade math and science teacher in Springfield Public Schools. I'm very much a teacher leader and have been since I came to Springfield, and I would greatly appreciate the opportunity of a teacher leader license. I am constantly being an innovative teacher in my classroom, using instructional technologies and facilitating teacher collaborations. And having a teacher leader license would be that next benchmark, a recognition that shows that I'm an innovative leader in the classroom and in my community. And currently, in Springfield, we have a master teacher program that's being created, and I have recently applied because I want to be a part of that and as an opportunity to be formally recognized and to continue to inspire teachers around me during our collaboration time, visit other schools, and lead workshops. I attend technology trainings and seminars, and I speak at fundraising events in Springfield, and this would just be a nice little capstone on there to be recognized for that leadership. And I know many teachers, including myself, who may not want to be administrators eventually, but just be teacher leaders. They love being in the classroom. They love working with teachers and improving instruction. And this would be a formal acknowledgement of their leadership. And by empowering teacher leaders to be recognized and share their expertise, all of us benefit, because teachers come from a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of expertise, and drawing on that wealth of knowledge is wonderful. And by doing that, teachers can be peer coaches and drop in and offer opportunities for teachers to see model lessons, etc., that would be really wonderful for teachers to implement in their classrooms. And arguably, currently practicing teachers have a better understanding of instructional practices than principals do. And principals do not have the capacity to be just the school leader. All teachers should have the opportunity to be empowered to have leadership and meet the increasingly diverse needs of our students. I also want to advocate for educational assistants. The educational assistants are invaluable in meeting the needs of our students. Our vision as a district, every student, a graduate prepared for a bright and successful future. Educational assistants certainly deserve the recognition for their work, just as I, as a teacher, need for my work. And the career pathway created in the Dash 8 amendments offers that recognition. And for example, currently in my building, there is a instructional assistant who has been an instructional assistant for 30 years. And when I talked with her about the opportunity to the career pathway, she thought that would have been a wonderful opportunity, an enticing prospect 30 years ago when she began her career as an instructional assistant. So please support House Bill 3254 and the Dash 8 amendments. Thank you, Chair Haas.
Thank you,
the committee.
Mr. Chair, there is a Dash 8 amendment that's been prepared for the committee's consideration. It addresses an unintended effect of that change the association membership of educational assistants. And basically what the amendment, instead of an instructor license, the Dash 8 develops a career pathway for educational assistants. And the goal of the original bill is maintained in the Dash 8 amendment, which is to encourage educational assistants to continue education and for some to ultimately become licensed teachers. So in summary, too many great teachers leave the classroom to become administrators. We want to keep those people in the classroom wherever they want to. So we want to support this legislation because our work in school districts has identified a desire among teachers for leadership opportunities without leaving the classroom. So
I think that's a really excellent point, and I think Senator Roblin would agree that we lose a lot of good teachers to the administrative ranks, don't we?
We do.
The name change is the only thing that's different in this amendment from the original bill?
Well, I don't know if I'd describe it just simply as a name change, because what the original bill would have created was a tier of licensure for educational assistance.
But it doesn't change any of that. It just changes the name.
Well, it makes it a pathway, and therefore we don't run into contractual language concerns around what licensure means.
That's right.
And OEAS was the
name. Yeah, we're doing this with an understanding that the Teacher Standards Practice Commission will develop the criteria to figure out what this license means. But it also says that a school district, through evaluation, can identify. Is it that and the other? Does it take both of those as you read this bill, both the evaluation at the school district that says this person meets our criteria for being a leader, and then some other criteria that will eventually be developed by the Teacher Standards Practice Commission, that we don't know what that is, that will identify the difference between a teacher leader and a professional teacher license?
Well, to be clear, Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, nothing in the legislation changes TSPC's role.
Right.
And so they would determine the appropriate requirements, necessary content knowledge. That job still remains with TSPC for the initial license, the professional license, and this new teacher leader license.
Okay. So if we write it, what we're doing is we're giving them the go-ahead to go forth and make these, figure out what that looks like.
That's correct, which
could
is
include more
current statute for the existing licensure.
Right, which could include more college work. It could include demonstration at a school site, a bunch of things, right? You're not limiting any of that. It's just they need to figure it out. And once they get that in place, we can actually start giving out this license.
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, that's correct. And it's our intent to remain engaged in that process with TSPC as they're developing their rules around this.
So all of these other things regarding pay grades, I suppose, would evolve after that process?
That's right. There's nothing in this legislation related to pay grades.
I will say, you know, the Milken group has been working on this for a lot of years as well, and having received that, I've watched that process going on, and they recognize clearly in other deals that having a pathways that increase it keeps best teachers in schools and allows them to do some other kinds of things. So I am very in favor of the concept in the bill. I just need to look at as what TSPC does as we go on, because I think it can be very helpful for our schools. I've always felt that, you know, the medical model where you have, you know, the person up here that's overseeing a bunch of other people can get a lot of work done and can create the kind of pathway you want. And I see this thing as being the similar kind of thing, where you have a master teacher or a leader teacher who has another group of people that are working there and a group of kids that they all are responsible for, making it work better for us in the long run. So I look forward to the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Haas and Senator Roblin, and there's some folks that are in the room today who are hanging on your every word.
Okay. Yeah, thanks.
As we often do with them. Further questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Andrea Cooper and Tricia Smith. I have to say, when I see the summary here and the first four words say abolishes continuing teacher license, it gives me pause.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I'm here today to testify in support of the Dash 8 amendment to House Bill 3254, and with that amendment, support of the bill. We are very excited to work with the Chalkboard Project on a new program that will allow our educational assistants who are interested in becoming teachers a pathway to that goal. This bill does, as it will be amended, I hope, with the Dash 8 amendments, does not impact the good work that educational assistants do today, but will give those educational assistants who want to become credentialed teachers that opportunity while they continue to do the good work in their jobs. So we think it's a great idea. Where it has been implemented in school districts that we're aware of, that our members are working in, they've been very pleased, and we're here in support of the amendment.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Andrea Cooper with the Oregon Education Association. I will be brief and also share our support for this bill. I think all of you know that teachers make a direct impact in the lives of their students, but they also have a positive impact on the overall school community. And I think, as recognized in this bill, an impact on their fellow educators' professional practice. And we believe this type of optional licensure not only provides recognition, but it elevates the entire practice of teaching. I also did want to just put on the record our thanks to Representative Comp, Vicki Chamberlain, the governor's staff, Chalkboard, OSCA. Eight amendments is no small feat, but I think along the way there was a lot of collaborative work and ultimately good policy before you. So thank you for the opportunity.
Senator Rubin. I just want to say that one of my most endearing friendships was with an OSCA member who was a math tutor and I believe was probably one of the top mathematicians in our school. And every student that had the opportunity to be in her assisted study hall, basically, is what it was, and could ask a question, would attest to the fact that they learned math in large part because of that skilled person who we asked often if she wanted to become a teacher because we would have all helped, but she didn't. She really, truly enjoyed exactly the role she was in, and she loved being a member of OSCA and not being a teacher and doing her thing with kids one-on-one and, you know, in a study hall situation. She didn't see herself as planning a lesson and doing all of the things, which she recognized and she supported. Teachers were very different from hers. But I think we all noticed, and all of the members of her association, if they had a math problem, they'd go to her too. So, I mean, she had elevated status, but I think this kind of thing allows us in the schools to differentiate some of the people who we all know are dedicated in whatever it is they're doing, whether they want to be a teacher or whether they want to be a member of the classified staff. They're dedicated to what they're doing and trying to make the best impact they can on their schools and are really valuable, and I think we forget that sometimes. And I think this kind of stuff can elevate all of those in ways that we have done before. And I appreciate you catching the dash aids.
Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, thank you for those comments. We agree with you completely. Many of our educational assistants are educational assistants on purpose.
Right.
They want to be those direct one-on-one teachers with students that they are. They don't want to be certified teachers in front of a classroom of 30 or 40 or 50 or 60. They would rather sit across the table from one student and teach that student, and that's what they do today. We have educational assistants who used to be teachers, and they are now educational assistants so they can provide that direct teaching that they could not provide as certified teachers. We also have EAs who want to become certified teachers, and that's the benefit of the Dash 8 Amendment, is that it allows them to pursue that goal, that career goal, without impacting those educational assistants who are doing just exactly what they want to do.
Okay. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3254, and we will bring that back up next week. We have 10 minutes left here, and I know we have some parents who want to weigh in on House Bill 2747. I can spot parents a mile away. So let me open up a public hearing on House Bill 2747 and call up Jill Hall, Kristen Constam, and Michelle Janke. I'm so sorry, but we have about 10 minutes left, and so I didn't want to close down.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jill Hall, and I'm a parent of three male graduates of Riverdale High School. When my youngest son graduated last year, I stayed on as a volunteer college counselor because Riverdale doesn't have enough funding for a dedicated college counselor, so that is kind of my capacity at Riverdale. I'm here today to encourage all of you to defeat House Bill 2747. Here's the dilemma. School districts are fighting every day to provide services to all students in their districts with less than adequate funding. The news that districts will receive 12% more in funding than last year for the next biennium is certainly good news. However, Oregon schools are still woefully underfunded. While I applaud the Senate Education Committee's work towards serving the best interests of Oregon students, piecemeal policies, such as those advocated in 2747, only serve to set districts back. Oregon law encourages districts to offer transfers, open enrollment, and tuition options for students seeking educational choice. It goes without saying that ideally, fully funded schools with myriad program offerings would most likely decrease movement between districts. In the meantime, I believe the current practice is a good one, as there are many good reasons students seek a better fit for them. Music, athletics, TAG, foreign language immersion, special educational services, school size are all reasons families may seek to make a change for their children. This is a good thing, but the idea of fit is one that goes both ways. In addition to family priorities, school districts must have transparency to determine their ability to meet a student's unique needs, mainly from a resource standpoint, space staffing program. If it happens that a student's passion and needs and a district's program may not intersect, this can currently be caught during discussion with the receiving district. Information opens the dialogue between families and schools to best suit the needs of students. House Bill 2747 closes it. Especially when a district receiving a new student becomes the resident district of that student, it's vital that the receiving district be able to have more information than this statute would allow. Public schools, especially, but not exclusively in smaller districts, walk a resource tightrope. Without district ability to ascertain and ensure that they can meet a student's need, whether it's accelerated math, foreign language, IEP 504 requirements, or other circumstances, nobody concerned is served to the level we must demand for our children. Unfortunately, this bill serves neither the best interests of students or of school districts. Please defeat the bill. Thank you.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Kristen Constam, and I have been on the Riverdale School Board for the last 7 years. I am also a parent of two Riverdale students, a senior and a freshman, both at the high school. I'm here to urge you to oppose House Bill 2747, which prohibits receiving districts from requesting any information about transfer students beyond name, age, and grade level. In the words of legal counsel to Lake Oswego, Riverdale, and dozens of other school districts in the state, House Bill 2747 will effectively kill the inter-district transfer process that has existed for a long time between districts. The mere fact that districts know nothing about the extra expenditures that may be created by those incoming students or the disciplinary history of the students will make them not worth the risk. The bill does this by prohibiting a receiving district from asking any questions of the incoming student, only name, age, and grade. The receiving district may not ask for transcripts, school grades, suspension or expulsion history, criminal records, or require a student visit the school or program. This puts my superintendent in a bad position in terms of sussing out and meeting student requirements, and it actually harms the student by eliminating the important conversation between the receiving school and the prospective student about, is this school a good fit for you? This bill also prohibits any contracts or any time limits on student transfers as a student becomes a resident student in the receiving district. As the House Education Committee heard, Riverdale has become a sanctuary for many students who have transferred into us. They have found us as a small school and stayed within the public school system, but come to Riverdale. There are kids who have been bullied elsewhere. We have one student who had been in four different schools before coming to Riverdale as a freshman. She is now proudly a graduating senior and going on to Smith College. So during this time of great challenge for Oregon schools, when changes are being discussed for open enrollment, when school funding is uncertain due to PERS, this piecemeal bill adds additional uncertainty for school boards across the state. For this and all the reasons I've mentioned, I urge you to oppose 2747. I also urge you to come visit our district and see what we have going on, because we're very proud of it. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you, and thank you for your generous public service to our state and our children.
Chair Haas,
members of the committee. My name is Michelle Heel-Janke, and I would like to urge you today to consider the negative impacts on students of this bill. I'm the parent of two elementary school children, a small business owner. I'm a candidate for my local school board, and I'm unopposed. And I'm also a fourth-generation Oregonian. My grandfather grew up in Senator Roblin's district. My parents live in Senator Knope's district. And I spent a lot of time on Saturday nights in Senator Hass's district in high school. So I have a real passion for this state, and also for the hard work that all of you are doing for the state. And I hope it continues to be a place that our children can grow up and can meet their greatest potential. As you know, House Bill 2747 applies to all forms of student transfers, including open enrollment, inter-district transfers, and tuition students. This inter-district transfer system has, for many decades, been based on the idea of an open exchange between receiving and sending districts. This has helped ensure that the needs of students are understood, and that that both the receiving district and the sending district can talk and have a conversation about how they meet the needs of those students. This bill would essentially put a blindfold on the receiving district, accepting transfer students for whom the program might not exist to offer to meet the needs of those students is very risky. And as a result, I think you will see districts around the state shut down their borders and decide not to participate in transfers or open enrollment. This bill also tinkers with the ability of local school districts who have and local school boards who have been voted in by their district residents to make decisions about transfer policy. So I urge you to consider the impacts on local districts. And as a candidate myself for a school board, I believe that this would limit local control over some of those decisions. I believe that open enrollment is a good idea, and Riverdale participates in open enrollment. However, this bill will impact open enrollment because it will impact the kinds of information that districts receive about students, and that will impact their decision about whether they're going to participate in open enrollment in the future. As policymakers, I believe that you should consider a criteria of do no harm when you're making policy. And up to now, I have not heard any testimony of the great amounts of students who are harmed by the current system. In fact, the current system works, again, because there's an open conversation between districts. And you've heard testimony and you've received many letters about how parents believe this would harm their choice in choosing the right schools for their children. I'd also like to point out that you've received materials about admissions policies for one school, but if you're going to consider those, you should also look at the admissions policies for many other schools, such as the Beaverton IB program, the Tyler-Tualatin program. I have copies of those, which I'd be happy to share with you, and they all request information that is similar to those. So consider all of those before you make a decision on this. I urge you to consider opposing this bill, and thank you for allowing us to testify today.
Thank you for coming down. Questions?
Just one. I mean, my feeling about open enrollment is that it should be treated like anybody else that's going to move. So if somebody moved into your district, you don't get information to allow them to move in before they come there. I mean, the school district can't say, hey, check at the door before you buy a residence in our school district. We've got to check all these things on your kid before you do that. So public schools have to take everybody who is in their district.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't see how that's much different than having a system which a group of people say they want to be in, and then you just select some of those. It's the same as if they had moved into your district. So I don't know why having a selection policy separate from that for a select group of kids would make a difference. And I thought that this bill really applied only to the open enrollment deals when you've said your school's open, that there are other arrangements that you could do with districts that this doesn't apply.
This bill applies to all forms of transfers. It also applies to inter-district transfers.
Okay. I read it differently than that.
Okay.
Other questions? So you spent your Saturday nights in Beaverton?
I did.
Doesn't everyone?
We're out of time. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
We do have some more people to testify on 2747. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we're going to take another swing at this bill next week, and then we'll be carrying it over to another time. And thank you, committee. We have no further business before us. We are adjourned.
Thank you.